It is it's incredibly easy to get swept up in the hype of a new tool.
Oh, absolutely. It happens all the time.
Right. It's like imagine buying a brand new top-of-the-line sports car because everyone on the internet is saying, it's the fastest, most advanced vehicle on the market.
Yeah, the reviews are flawless.
Exactly. But then you bring it home and you realize you live at the end of a 10-mile dirt road.
Right. Not ideal.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
I mean, the engineering of the car is flawless, but the fit is just an absolute disaster.
Yeah, the tool isn't the problem, the fit is.
Exactly. And that is exactly what we are getting into today. Welcome to today's deep dive. Whether you're prepping for a massive tech migration yourself, or you're just, insanely curious about how these multi-million dollar business decisions are made, today's material is an absolute goldmine.
It really is. It's a fascinating look under the hood.
We are opening up a highly strategic internal guide. It's titled Azure versus AWS for SoCal Enterprises: How to Choose a Cloud Platform in 2026. And this was put together by a firm called Technegion.
Yeah, and what I love about this source is that it's not just a dry technical manual.
No, not at all. It is a look at a 2026 operational strategy designed to turn a highly technical choice into a measurable business advantage.
Right. It connects the servers to the actual business outcomes.
Yes. So our mission today is to extract the ultimate framework for evaluating cloud architecture. We want to figure out how to avoid falling into the trap of all that tech hype and really uncover how the right choice physically changes a business's operations.
And honestly, how it changes customer conversion, too.
Yes, because we constantly see companies struggle with these cloud decisions. And it's not a lack of tools, right?
No, definitely not. It's a failure of alignment. We constantly see leadership teams fall into the trap of what this document calls vendor momentum.
Vendor momentum. Okay,
Yeah.
what does that actually look like in practice?
Well, you look at a massive brand like Microsoft Azure or Amazon Web Services. You see their huge market share. You read all the breathless tech articles, and you just assume that that momentum automatically translates to a perfect solution for your specific operational needs.
Right. Like everyone else is using it, so it must be right for us.
Exactly. But making a choice based on external hype rather than your own internal business reality, I mean, that creates systemic risk.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if a company makes a massive multi-year commitment to a cloud infrastructure that doesn't fit its operational reality, unwinding that decision later is a complete nightmare.
Oh, it's nearly impossible. It's like pouring concrete.
Yes. Once those data structures are set and the applications are all entangled in the platform, you are stuck with that layout.
You really are. And the guide lists some major warning signs of this mismatch. Things like unclear ownership or surprise billing spikes.
Which nobody likes.
Right. But the one that really stands out the most is integration friction.
Integration friction. That sounds expensive.
It is. What's fascinating here is that integration friction is where the hidden costs really multiply. When a business ignores its own internal context and just buys the industry darling, they inevitably end up with systems that, well, they refuse to talk to each other natively.
Oh, man. And when software systems don't talk, human beings have to step in to bridge the gap.
Precisely. You end up relying on manual workarounds.
So you start relying on like manual data entry, or maybe relying on a specific employee's memory to move files around, or you just kind of accept incomplete data visibility across the company.
Yeah, which inherently introduces massive operational fragility. I mean, let's look at the real-world architectural differences between these two
Okay,
platforms.
lay it on me.
So, Azure, for example, integrates seamlessly if an enterprise is already heavily invested in legacy Microsoft licenses, things like Active Directory or Office 365.
That makes sense. It's all the same family.
Right. If you choose Azure in that scenario, you can save millions in hidden licensing and training costs because the ecosystem natively trusts itself.
But what if they went with AWS instead?
Well, if you choose AWS in that same scenario, just because, say, a few executives read it was the fastest growing cloud, you now have to build complex custom bridges just to force your Microsoft tools to authenticate with Amazon servers.
Oh, wow. So you're just creating unnecessary work.
Exactly. But conversely, if your development team is building a custom app from scratch and needs raw, unopinionated agility, AWS might offer superior flexibility where Azure might feel overly prescriptive.
Okay, I hear the architectural differences, but let me challenge the premise here for a second.
Sure, go for it.
Isn't cloud infrastructure fundamentally an IT department problem? Like, why does this strategy guide focus so heavily on customer conversion optimization and sales teams? Help me connect the dots between a back-end server choice and, say, a customer deciding to abandon their online shopping cart?
That is a great question. And honestly, that assumption right there is why so many migrations fail to deliver a return on investment. Let's trace some mechanics of that integration friction down to the user level.
Okay, let's trace it.
Let's say your front-end website has to verify a user's credentials before they can check out. But because of that platform mismatch we just discussed, the site has to make 5 separate, inefficient API calls to a legacy database.
Just to log them in?
Yeah, just to verify them. On the IT dashboard, that's logged as an architecture issue. But physically, that process adds, say, 400 milliseconds of loading time to every single click the user makes.
Ah, I see where this is going. And to the customer, 400 milliseconds feels like an absolute eternity.
It really does. They don't know you have API inefficiencies.
Right. They just know the website feels broken or it's unresponsive or honestly just untrustworthy.
Exactly. They experience an inconsistent digital experience. Or maybe a customer service representative takes an extra 2 minutes to pull up an account history while the customer just waits on hold.
Oof. Yeah. That kills trust immediately.
And those slow answers directly kill conversion rates. These internal tech struggles are highly visible to the end user. Choosing between Azure and AWS isn't just about giving the engineering team new toys.
Yeah, it's business critical.
It is entirely about protecting your business's ability to seamlessly convert a lead into revenue.
Wow. Okay, so the root cause of failure is treating cloud architecture as an isolated, locked-away IT project, which really begs the question, how should leadership actually evaluate this choice?
Well, this is where the guide gets really practical. Technigen's guide maps out a very rigid 3-phase implementation roadmap.
Yeah, and phase 1 demands a really narrow focus, right? It requires teams to score Azure and AWS against specific non-negotiable pillars.
Yes, they list identity, data, workload compliance, skills, integration, and long-term product roadmap needs.
That is a lot to consider.
It is, but those pillars are the antidote to vendor momentum. Instead of asking which platform is better, you are forced to ask which platform aligns with our current reality.
Which is a much better question.
Let's take workload and skills as examples. Workload isn't just a tech buzzword. It means looking at the actual computing power required for your daily tasks.
Like what kind of tasks?
Well, are you running real-time, AI-driven inventory checks thousands of times a minute? Or are you mostly storing cold, archived financial data? The platforms handle those demands differently, and more importantly, they price them differently.
Right. That makes a ton of sense.
Yeah.
And the skills pillar, I mean, is the massive trap I see companies fall into all the time.
Oh, absolutely.
You purchase a massive AWS contract, but your entire internal engineering team has spent the last 10 years strictly managing Microsoft environments.
Yeah, you don't just have a new tool, you now have a massive skills deficit.
Exactly. You either have to halt your momentum to retrain everyone, or you have to go out and hire wildly expensive AWS architects just to keep the lights on.
Which brings us to the most critical mandate in phase 1.
Yeah.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the output of these evaluations cannot just be a meeting.
Right, you need something tangible.
The documentation stresses the absolute necessity of establishing a mathematical baseline of your current state before a single server is moved.
A mathematical baseline?
Yes. You have to document who currently owns the workflow, which systems are involved right now, and exactly how success is currently measured. Without a starting point, you can never objectively prove the migration was actually worth the investment.
It's like starting a diet without stepping on a scale first.
That's exactly it.
I mean, you might feel like you're running faster, you might buy expensive running shoes,
mm-hmm.
but you have no hard physiological data to prove you aren't doing, you know, hidden damage to your body. You need a baseline to measure actual health.
That's a really strong way to frame it. It's not just about tracking superficial progress. It's about uncovering hidden fatal risks before you push your system to the limit.
Right.
And this leads directly into phase 2, which focuses on strict measurement. The mandate here is to define your metrics before making the jump.
Okay, so what kind of metrics are we talking about?
Are you tracking API response times? The reduction in IT support tickets generated per week? The improvement in the checkout conversion rate? You must define what you are measuring, the frequency of the review, and crucially, the escalation path if that metric starts trending downward.
The documentation drops a very stark warning here that I really want to highlight for you. It warns leadership against measuring activity instead of outcomes.
Yes, that is vital.
But in a massive corporate environment, how do we prevent this entire 3-phase blueprint from just deteriorating into another bureaucratic checklist? where managers pop champagne just because a launch meeting happened.
It happens all the time. The confusion between activity and outcome is the silent killer of enterprise tech projects.
The silent killer. I love that phrasing.
It's true. Publishing a web portal, signing a software license agreement, holding a three-hour vendor planning session, those are all activities.
Right. They feel like work.
They cost money and they take time, but they do not prove success. Success is exclusively an outcome. Did that activity definitively reduce our compliance risk? Did it mathematically improve our application load times?
So how do you enforce that focus on outcomes?
That is exactly what phase three of the blueprint is for, standardizing ownership. It is specifically engineered to enforce this distinction.
So turning the migration from a one-off project into a repeatable operating habit.
Right. Once the new cloud infrastructure is live, a specific named individual has to own the maintenance, the reporting, and the vendor coordination.
So no pointing fingers later.
Exactly. Migrations fail when they become orphaned projects after the go-live date. Assigning long-term ownership guarantees someone is tracking those defined outcomes over the next 5 years, rather than just celebrating the activity of the launch day.
Okay, so we know we need to establish a baseline, focus on outcomes over activities, and enforce continuous ownership. But a framework can't execute itself in a vacuum.
No, it certainly can't.
Businesses don't operate in a theoretical white space, right? They operate in physical markets. And here's where it gets really interesting. What I find incredibly unique about this strategy guide is that it introduces geographic location as a core variable in a cloud computing choice.
Yeah, specifically the local conditions of Orange County and Southern California.
Right. Like, why does the physical location matter for a cloud platform?
Well, the local operational context changes the math entirely. Generic national tech advice usually fails because it assumes all markets have the exact same tolerance for friction.
And SoCal is different.
Very different. The Southern California business landscape is hyper-competitive. You're dealing with sophisticated B2B clients, heavy tech startup density, and an end user base that demands instantaneous, secure digital workflows.
So they're not very patient.
Not at all. If you read a generic article about cloud architecture, it won't factor in that your local competitors are likely investing heavily in low latency edge caching just to serve those local customers faster.
Wow, so it's counterintuitive because we are conditioned to think of the cloud as this, omnipresent, borderless entity.
Exactly, floating up in the sky.
Right. But an enterprise's technical stack ultimately has to reflect the specific, aggressive demands of its physical local market. If your SoCal competitors are offering seamless, real-time digital experiences and your architecture is lagging because your servers are routing inefficiently, you lose market share local.
We do. And to prevent that kind of architectural lag, the strategy points to external, globally validated standards. Specifically, it mandates grounding these infrastructure decisions in the AWS Well-Architected Framework and the Azure Well-Architected Framework.
I really like how they bring those in. These frameworks aren't just suggestions. They function almost like municipal building codes for the cloud.
That's a perfect analogy.
They are rigid best practices for security, efficiency, and cost optimization designed by the platform creators themselves to ensure the infrastructure doesn't just collapse under its own weight.
Right. They are a critical safety net against architectural drift. When a company is making an enterprise decision that will scale into the millions of dollars and affect the workflow of every single employee, you cannot just wing the setup based on what a lead engineer remembers doing at their last job.
No, you definitely can't wing this.
Validating your decisions against those frameworks ensures you are building on a globally recognized foundation.
And the reality of architectural drift is constant. You don't just pass the building inspection once and ignore the structure for 5 years.
You'd be surprised how many companies do exactly that.
Which is terrifying. The guide is explicit here. Without continuous review against those frameworks, the exact same friction you paid to fix will creep back in the minute key staff members turn over, or, a new marketing tool is bolted onto the side of the system.
Maintaining those standards requires human beings sitting at the keyboard keeping the infrastructure aligned. To survive the competitive pressures of the market, you need a very specific team structure holding the purse strings and managing the execution.
Which brings us to the actual execution layer. Building the dream team.
Yes, team structure is everything here.
The strategy outlines a dual owner system to manage the migration. So you have one business owner and one technical or marketing owner. The business owner's mandate is to define why this migration matters to the company's bottom line.
Right.
And the technical owner's mandate is to define the how, the very first practical steps for implementation. Why is it set up this way?
It's a structural safeguard against two very common extremes. When a migration is led solely by business executives, the project becomes way too abstract and detached from the physical limitations of the technology.
They just ask for magic.
Exactly. Just put it in the cloud. But when it is led solely by IT, it gets bogged down in the technical weeds and completely loses sight of the customer experience. The dual owner system forces a permanent, uncomfortable, but very necessary friction between the why and the how.
Okay, so let's put that friction to the test, especially when it comes to the most difficult part of any migration, securing the budget.
Oh, the budget, the ultimate friction.
Right. Getting a CEO and a lead engineer to see eye to eye on cloud spend is notoriously difficult. But the budgeting strategy in the document introduces a rule to completely separate funding requests into two categories: urgent fixes and maturity improvements.
This raises an important question about how we present costs. Lumping those together is exactly how budget requests die in the boardroom.
So what does this all mean? If I'm a CTO trying to get funding for this migration, it sounds like my biggest hurdle is getting the CEO to understand this cost. How exactly does separating urgent fixes from maturity improvements help win that budget argument?
Well, if an IT leader goes to the CEO and asks for a massive lump sum to, quote, migrate to Azure to improve our data governance and maturity, the CEO just hears an expensive optional luxury.
Right. It sounds nice to have, but not urgent.
Exactly. But if you separate them, you completely change the psychology of the request. Urgent fixes are immediate security vulnerabilities, broken checkout paths, or severe server latency.
Things on fire.
Yes. Maturity improvements are the nice to haves that build long-term strength. Things like automated reporting dashboards or enhanced staff training.
I'd argue the hardest part of separating those is forcing the IT team to admit that not every technical debt is a literal emergency. How does the team objectively decide what goes into the urgent bucket?
By calculating the cost of inaction, it forces leaders to look at a technical flaw and ask, what physically happens to our revenue or our risk profile if we leave this specific issue unresolved for one more quarter?
Let's role play that.
Okay, let's do it.
If I'm a CTO sitting across from my CEO, I don't use IT jargon to justify the urgent fix. I use the cost of inaction. I say, our current database latency is causing a 4% drop in card conversions every single Tuesday afternoon.
Oh.
Right. That is an urgent fix. The cost of inaction is bleeding that 4% of revenue every single week for the next 3 months. We need budget X to stop the bleeding today. Next year, we can discuss budget Y for the maturity improvements, like automating our weekly reports.
That is brilliant. You've attached a literal dollar amount and a specific customer impact to the delay. That removes the emotion from the budget request entirely.
It's just math at that point.
Exactly. And speaking of removing jargon, this concept of translation applies directly to partner accountability as well. If a company brings in an external consulting firm to assist with this migration, like Technogene, the business leadership must demand what the guide calls plain language reporting.
Plain language, meaning the executive team shouldn't need a computer science degree to know if the project they funded is succeeding.
Exactly.
If I'm the CEO, don't hand me a report that says, we recalibrated the differential timing matrix on the SQL cluster. Tell me, we optimized the database querying, which reduced customer wait times on the portal by 15%.
A valuable partner doesn't just execute tasks in a black box. They translate technical actions into measurable business outcomes. The ultimate signal of success for a migration is not achieving some flawless futuristic tech stack.
Yeah.
No, it is controlled progress. It is having visible, plain language evidence that the operational reality today is demonstrably better than the baseline you documented back in phase one.
Controlled progress over perfection. I think that is the core takeaway here. Let's synthesize these insights for everyone listening.
Let's do it, Jeff.
Choosing between Azure and AWS in 2026 is fundamentally not about picking a brand name or chasing industry trends. It is a strict, localized evaluation of business fit.
Absolutely.
Success means having a documented, measurable operating habit where you know exactly what changed, why it changed, the mathematical outcome of that change, and the name of the human being who owns it moving forward.
And for leadership teams facing this architectural crossroads right now, the most practical advice is to follow the 30-day action checklist.
Right. Don't wait.
Within the next 30 days, your mandate is to confirm that initial baseline. Assign one single accountable owner for the very first phase of improvement. objectively review your main risks, whether that's integration friction or local compliance gaps, and then immediately schedule the next review date. Do not let the strategy sit in a drawer.
It's really about turning complex technical anxiety into manageable execution. Which brings us to a final thought for you to chew on today.
This is the mind-expanding part.
Yeah. We've spent this entire deep dive evaluating how to choose between massive, monolithic cloud platforms based on business fit in the context of 2026. But as we look toward the end of the decade, the landscape is shifting dramatically.
It's moving so fast.
With the exponential explosion of artificial intelligence optimization and edge computing, which, you know, physically moves processing power away from centralized server farms and closer to the local user in places like Southern California, will the concept of choosing a single cloud platform even exist in a few years?
Wow, yeah.
Think about microservices not as a single car, but as a massive restaurant kitchen where you hire a highly specialized chef for every single ingredient. Will businesses soon seamlessly and automatically rent fragmented microservices from Azure, AWS, and Google simultaneously, minute by minute, driven by AI systems, constantly hunting for the lowest latency and the cheapest compute cost?
That's entirely possible.
Will this entire debate over choosing one platform become completely obsolete because your architecture dynamically assembles itself based on the terrain?
The evolution of decentralized architecture makes that a very real possibility. The technology is moving so aggressively that the mental models we use to purchase server space today might be totally unrecognizable in a decade.
Something to keep in mind as you plan your long-term roadmaps. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. You are now armed with the mental models to navigate information overload, cut through the vendor hype, and make bulletproof technical decisions that drive actual business outcomes.
It was a pleasure unpacking this.
Because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how flawless the engineering is if the tool can't handle the road you're actually driving on. Keep questioning, keep learning, and we'll see you next time.